Today is fast day.
Is there...
You know, it's the day, today is the fast day of the 8th of Tevet. I know that it sounds a little strange because whenever you say what fast day is, it's, isn't that Friday? It's the 10th of Tevet. I said, yes. So to just to clarify before getting started, there are four fasts that are related to Churban Beit HaMikdash that are mentioned in one mention only together in one pasuk in Zechariah Chet. We studied that pasuk a few years ago when we studied Zechariah Zayin Chet. And that's the fast of the 10th month. There's a machloka, the Gemara, what fast that is. We end up ruling that it's the fast of the 10th of Tevet, which is the day that the siege started on Jerusalem in 588 BCE. However, in a much later book, and you're taking a look in source one at not that book, but at something copied from that book, in a much later book that the provenance is somewhere in the 8th or 9th centuries in the time of the Gaonim, there is a book called Megillat Ta'anit Batra. Now, you're familiar with Megillat Ta'anit. We've talked about it in the past. Megillat Ta'anit is a first century composition that lists days in which you're not allowed to fast. And most prominent there, of course, is Chanukah and Purim. The rest is a lot of other days that are not observed anymore. The Gemara paskins, the Megillat Ta'anit Batla, when the Mikdash was destroyed, all those days lost their significance, except Chanukah and Purim. But Megillat Ta'anit Batra is actually a scroll of fasts, meaning a list of all sorts of days on which terrible things happen, and we do fast. It's the opposite of the original Megillat Ta'anit. Professor Shulamit Elitzur has really done the serious work on Megillat Ta'anit Batra, and there are numerous versions of it with, by the way, numerous different dates for different people dying. So in other words, when did Yehoshua ben Nun pass away? So according to one, it's on the 18th of Iyar. We did that once with the Lag BaOmer shiur. According to others, it's on the 26th of Nisan. So, okay, and either way, that's considered a fast day. And the interesting thing is that the Shulchan Aruch paskins that you should fast on these days. And it lists these days. But Tevet has 3 days in a row. The 10th of Tevet, which is in the Nevi'im, it's in Shulchan Aruch. You have to fast that day. There's also an interesting halachot about the fact that it's on Friday this year as it comes out once in a while. By the way, parenthetically, the Abu Dirham actually says that if it were to fall on Shabbat, which it can't do in our calendar system, you'd fast. Unlike the other fasts for the Mikdash, because of Etzem Hayom Hazeh, we haven't really tested that theory at all. Tomorrow is the famous fast that Ed mentioned before the Shiur, asked a question about, and Chazal say, or Megillat Ta'anit Batra, post-Chazal, says the 9th of Tevet's a fast day, and we don't know why. They didn't, Lam Ruama. And that, there's a lot of mechkar into why, and a lot of proposals, including some really, really strange proposals as to why we fast on that day. And sometime when the 9th of Tevet falls out on a Wednesday, maybe we'll do it again. But today is also a fast day listed in Megillat Ta'anit Batra, and the reason is given, which is B'shmona B'tevet, Nichtava Torah Yivanit, B'mei Talai HaMelech, and this is referring to the same very famous story that's recounted in the letter to Aristeas, the Gemara in Megillah, about the translation of the Torah, not the Tanakh, the Torah into Greek at the commission of Talmai, or on behalf of Talmai, probably Talmai the second, sometime in the third or second century BCE, to translate the Torah into Greek, famous story, the 70 elders, etc. And that leads to what we have today, the Septuagint, although the Septuagint we have in our hands, it may not be exactly the same text that they worked on, but that's what we have. But in that story in Megillah, it's presented as a miracle, and it's presented as something that favors Greek. And it's something that actually justifies the position that a Sefer Torah could be written in Greek, of the only other language besides Hebrew. In this take, it's actually a bad thing. We fast on the 8th of Tevet because today is the day over 2,000 years ago that the Torah was translated. We're assuming now either that it was translated in one day, or today is when it was started, or today is when it was finished. Some landmark in that process. And then the Agadah goes on to say, Uva choshech la'olam shlosha yamin. And the world was engulfed in darkness for 3 days. Now, my interest is not in the issue of Greek and the issue of the translation. My issue is in the second half of this, which is that the story that's told here is told in order to justify the fast. It's said, why would you want to fast because the Torah was translated into Greek? Aha, you see, it's a terrible thing because the world was engulfed in darkness for 3 days. I'm not concerned with the historicity of it. I don't have any external records that indicate that there was a plague of darkness over the whole world sometime in the 3rd century BCE. I'm not concerned with that. I'm more concerned with why are they telling me this? So before getting to the answer, which we're going to get to at the end of the shiur, I want to take a look at a few other agadot that show up in Chazal, which is more anchored than this one, and ask a few questions about them along the way. One of them is very famous, and I don't have to read it through, and that is because we just finished Chanukah, the Nes Pach HaShemen, which is mentioned, the only place it's mentioned in Chazal is in the Bavli on Shabbat. It's not mentioned in Yerushalmi. It's not mentioned in any Tanaitic literature. It's not mentioned before that. Famously, it is a story that first appears in the 4th and 5th centuries, which is in the clarification of the Megillat Tanit, and says in one version, this is one of the versions, one of the scholia of the Megillat Tanit says that they found the oil and a nace happened and it lasted for 8 days. We're all familiar with the story. There's no need to review it. I want to go to the third Agadah, which, by the way, is very different than the first two, because the first two both invoke miracles, and parenthetically, both involve miracles that of dark and light. There, darkness came to the world here, it lit for 8 days. I didn't bring those on that for that purpose, but it's an interesting little coincidence. The third is not at all miraculous, at least the part we're going to look at. This is one I would like to take up again after Pesach, when it's the period of year that we'd spend a lot of time talking about Rabbi Akiva and his students and Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. It's a story about Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, but I want to look at the opening part of the story, and this we'll take a look through. The Gemara in Shabbat is engaged in a discussion about why particular plagues come to the world. And it lists for this, this plague comes because of this sin, and this plague comes because of this sin. And then there's a discussion about what seems to be diphtheria and why it comes. And the Gemara mentions that Rabbi Yehuda Rosh HaMidabrim B'chol Makom said the following. Rabbi Yehuda, that's Rabbi Yehuda Rabbi Loi, the student of Rabbi Kiva, who had the title Prime Speaker. And then it goes on to say what he said about that particular thing. And then the Gemara, in a classic, in its classic form of ceding to those with ADD, because the Gemara does this all the time. The Gemara will bring some tangential text in order to prove a point. And there's something intriguing about that text, but the Gemara says, let's finish with our topic. Let's stay on focus. They finish the topic, and then they go back and say, hey, that was interesting. Let's look at that, right? So the way that the Gemara often does that is Amar Mar or Gufa. And here, the Gemara does it in a little bit of a larger way. It says, V'amai karulei rosh ha-medabrim b'chol makom. Why is Rabbi Yehuda have the title Prime Speaker? And the answer is because of this story. And this story spins off into the story of Rabbi Yoshim bar Yochai in the cave. But here's how it starts. Yatvei, you can follow it in English. Yatvi, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon. So these are, of course, three students of Rabbi Akiva. This is in the period after Bar Kokhba has been defeated and either during or after the Hadrianic persecutions. The Yativ Yehuda ben Gerim Gabayu. There was a particular Yehuda ben Gerim. You'll judge what you think of this guy anyways. So those are the three rabbis, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon. Patach Rabbi Yehuda v'Amar. Rabbi Yehuda started to speak about the Romans. Kama na'im ma'sein shel umazu. Look how wonderful the things the Romans do are. Tiknu shvakim, they made marketplaces. Tiknu sharim, they made bridges. Tiknu merchatzaot, they made bathhouses. Now, this is all true. And if we may remind you, I don't know how many of you remember The Life of Brian. It's a great movie. And in The Life of Brian, in the middle of it, there's a point at which all of the rebels get together and John Cleese leads them, and they're like, what have the Romans done for us? And one guy pops and says, well, they did bring plumbing. I said, okay, but besides plumbing, well, there's medical care. And then finally they end up with this long list. Besides, and this whole long thing, what did they do for us? Nothing. Oh, let's go do. So it gets them riled up, but they have to admit that life under Pax Romana had been, at least in a material sense, improved. And so Rabbi Yehuda, not anticipated in the movie, but Rabbi Yehuda here points that out about all the wonderful things they did. Rabbi Yossi shatak. Rabbi Yossi said nothing. Now, what you get a sense of is there's already some sort of pecking order here, because Rabbi Yehuda already was the first one to speak up. He opened the conversation. It's as if we all looked at Rabbi Yossi. What's he going to do? And Rabbi Yossi, is silent. That's his reaction. Next is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who seems to be the junior member of this troika. Shimon Bar Yochai, everything they made for themselves, which, by the way, isn't a bad thing necessarily. But everything they made for themselves was all self-serving. Why did they put marketplaces? So they'd have a place to put their prostitutes who would seduce our young men away. Why did they make bathhouses? Not for hygiene, but rather to pump, to primp and to preen and to pamper themselves. They made bridges so they could take taxes from us. Now, there's no question that any bit of progress that you look at in the world is something you can look at with two ways. People look at the internet, and some people look at it and say, what a terrible thing. People's attention span is getting shorter. People aren't doing research. They're relying on Google for everything. People have access to all sorts of terrible things. Social media has led to cyberbullying. All that's true. On the other hand, the fact that I can do amazing research into so many different areas of knowledge from my house, and even with all the closures that exist right now, I can still get that done, is amazing. I'm giving a shiur, and I've got a friend in Beit Shemesh who's part of the shiur. That's great. So you can look at it both ways. Rabbi Yehuda looks at these things of progress in a unilaterally positive way. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai turns it upside down and looks at it absolutely negatively. Okay? And this story seems to be some sort of a foundational story within Chazal. I'll show you why in a second. Sort of like a kind of a framework story. So much more spins off of it. And now what happened? Alach Yehuda ben Gerim siper divrayim. Now Yehuda ben Gerim here is presented not as necessarily a bad guy, but sort of a naive guy. He goes and repeats what was said. And he doesn't rat on them. He repeats what was said, which gives us the sense that this session was really a closed session. And it was really, you weren't supposed to repeat what happened, but he did. Nishma'ula Malchut, the Roman governors heard about it. Amru, and this is the decree they made. Yehuda she'ila yit'aleh. Now, by the way, notice the Romans have great poetry here. Yehuda she'ila yit'aleh. Yehuda, who elevated us, will be elevated. By the way, it's an interesting thing because it means, remember, we're explaining why Yehuda is the Rosh HaMedabrim. And the answer is, the Romans made him Rosh HaMedabrim. Now, do we like that or we don't like that? Unclear. But we respect that position, which he got because he praised the Romans. Yossi sheshatak iglal et tzipori. Yossi, the Romans say, who was silent, will go into exile to his hometown. All right, lockdown. Shimon Shigina Yehareg, Shimon, who degraded us, will be killed. And from that spins off to the story of the cave. I just want to keep an eye on that story. And one related story, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, it later shows up in a very late Midrash in Shemot Rabbah, but the Gemara in Sanhedrin tells us the following. And you'll see how this story spins off of that story. Now, this is interesting because the story that we just read was a story about the second century CE that happened in the period of the Mishnah. This story happened in the year, we'll call it 1250 BCE in Egypt. There were three people who were counselors of Paro who were there when Paro was deciding what to do about the kids, meaning the drown the kids, etc. Eloin, Bil'am, Iyov, v'Yitro. These are three biblical characters who in the Tanakh never meet. Of course, according to one opinion, Chazal, Iyov didn't even exist. They weren't anywhere in geographic proximity to each other, but the Midrash brings them together. Bil'am shiyi eitz neharag. And now they credit Bil'am with being the one who gave the eitzah to drown the children. So the decree was Bil'am, who gave that eitzah, he's going to die. And he dies later on the battlefield. Eov Shishatak, Eov in this story, said nothing. Nidon b'Yisurin. So he's going to suffer a terrible life, a terrible series of afflictions, and that's the book of Eov, or the story of Eov. V'Yitro Shebarach, Yitro ran away. So what does he get? Zachu b'nei v'nav l'shev l'shkat ha-gazid. He had descendants who were on the Sanhedrin. Now, notice that this takes the story that we had and flips it. In other words, in our original story, we have Yehuda praising, and Yehuda therefore gets elevated. That's Yitro here, but Yitro is the one who ran away. Eov is in the middle like Rabbi Yossi, and Bilam, who's the gave the Eitzah to kill the kids, he's like Rabbi Shimon, Lahavdil, a million Havdalot, in that he is going to die. But the difference, of course, is that in the story in Shabbat, it's the Romans making the decree. In the Gemara and Sanhedrin, it's God making the decree. But notice that the parallels between these stories. I want to show you two more stories. One of them continues with Rav Shimon bar Yochai, and one of them elsewhere. I'm going to just summarize them quickly. In the Rav Shimon bar Yochai story, which again we'll take up in greater detail in the spring, Mirtz Hashem, Rav Shimon bar Yochai runs away with his son eventually, and they find a cave. They go to the cave, and a miracle happens, and a carob tree sprouts up, and a spring of water suddenly appears, and they're able to live for 12 years in that cave eating carobs and drinking water from that miraculous place. Who comes to tell them that the decree is up because Caesar has died, and therefore there's an amnesty for anybody who insulted him, and they can go, the decree is off? Ata Eliyahu, Eliyahu Navi comes, v'kam apitcha d'ma'arta, and he shows up at the door, at the opening of the cave, and he announces that the decree is off. One more story I want to show you, and that's a story about Unklus. Unklus, who is the storied author of the famous Targum, okay? The story goes, I'm just going to summarize it quickly, as you can see it in front of you, that Unklus wanted converted. And so he was related to the royal family, and they wanted to, interrogate him a little bit. So they sent a group of soldiers. The first group of soldiers who came to Unklus, and he started talking about them, about Psukim, et cetera, and before you knew it, they all converted. So they sent another group and said, don't talk to him. So they went in, they didn't talk to him, all right? But on the way out, he said, let me just point something out. Who goes in front of whom, the legion or the king? So he said, the legion goes first. He says, in our case, the king goes first, and he quotes the pasuk that Hashem led us out of Mitzrayim. Okay, so they all convert. So the next third group is told, don't talk to them, don't anything. So they're on their way out the door, and he touches the mezuzah, and they say, what's that? A big mistake. He says, well, normally a king is guarded on the outside. Here, our king guards us from the outside. Oh, they all convert, and they give up on Unklus. Okay, that last story is familiar to us. It's familiar to us from a story in Sefer Shmuel. In Sefer Shmuel, David ran away from Shaul, and David ran to Ramah, where Shmuel the Navi was. And David joins in as Shmuel is doing a prophetic experience with his students. And Shaul sends a group of soldiers to go get David and kill him. The soldiers come, and what happens to them? They're seized by the spirit of prophecy. He sends a second group. They're seized by the spirit of prophecy. He sends a third group. They're seized by the spirit of prophecy. And of course, David is still safe. So Shaul finally says, if you want to get a job done right, do it yourself. He goes, and by the time he gets there, he's seized by the spirit of prophecy. And as he's having his prophecy, David runs away. Now, why am I pointing that out to you? Because look at the way that Chazal tell the story of Unklus. The blueprint for the story about Unklus is the story about Shaul and David. What's happening here? It's as follows. When Chazal tell stories, and the point of Chazal's stories is always not a history lesson, but it's a point. The way that they fashion the stories and the way that they fashion how the story is told is often based on a blueprint in Tanakh. So we started with the last story. The story about Unklus seems to be patterned very clearly after the story of Shaul and David. Let's go backwards. The story about Rav Shimon bar Yochai in the cave. The very first time we meet Eliyahu HaNavi, he gets up and declares famine, drought, no rain. God tells him to go down to Nachal Crete. You have it right here in Malachim Aleph Yud Zayin. And he says, you will drink from the Nachal, and the ravens are going to bring you food every morning and every evening. Interesting agadot about that and the ravens. The point is that Eliyahu is hiding out from a decree on his life by the king. He's hiding in an area of caverns, and there is a river that gives him water and miraculously food. Exactly. And by the way, who is it who comes to tell B'Shem Bayochai that you're able to leave? Eliyahu, as if to say, this is my cave. You're hanging out in my cave, and I'm coming to let you know you can go. We roll back, and remember how that whole story started. The story started because Rav Shimon bar Yochai was the one to degrade the Romans. What was the Roman decree? Yehuda she'ila yit'aleh. Yossi she'shatak yiglah, and Shimon she'gina yehareg. Right? That was the way the Romans framed it. I want to take a look at next week's Parsha. Next week's Parsha, the highlight, the middle of the Parsha is Yaakov on his deathbed giving brachot, or in some cases more like a mishaberach, to his sons. Okay. Who is the one son in the whole family who actually gets a raise in this whole story? It's Yehuda. Yehuda is turned into the king. Yehuda it'aleh. He is raised up. Which one of the sons has already been and remains the chief of the family in exile? The answer is Yosef. Yossi Yiglat. And which is the one son who gets most shafted of any son, starting here and then later on? The answer is Shimon. Right away, Shimon and Levi are torn apart. They're ripped apart by their father, evidently for what happened in Shechem, maybe for their hand in selling Yosef, unclear. Machloket Rishonim. But in the end, Levi saves himself at the Egel, and Shevet Levi becomes Mishartei Hashem. What happens to Shimon? Shimon's numbers drop precipitously in the desert. Shimon is the one who seems to be the instigator at the Avon Baal Peor. Shimon is the first tribe to really disappear off the map. And remember what the decree of the Romans was. Shimon Shigina Yehareg. And it's almost as if the wording of this decree of the Romans is built on this story of Yaakov. Yehuda, Yosef, and Shimon are three names of Yaakov's sons, each of whom at this scene is presented that way. Now, we go back to the story of Chanukah. And now, being sensitive to the idea that the way Chazal tells stories is built on a blueprint of Tanakh, because Chazal's hashkafa is that Tanakh is not just a flat storyline. It is a living, breathing thing where things continue to repeat. And by the way, rabbis and their sermons do the same thing. Think about the way that the Rav talked about Yosef and his brothers, and Yosef Dov Soloveitchik and his family. The first of the five drashot at the Chayanum Anochim Vakesh was talking about his attempts to somehow be able to coexist with the rest of the family, even though he had broken ranks with them and become involved with the Mizrahi. And so it's not a new idea, but you got to see it in Chazal. So when we have the very famous story of the oil and the oil that miraculously lasted, that's exactly the story of the woman, the widow with Elisha. Widow comes up to Elisha and says, you know, my husband was one of the Ben Anvim. We're poor as shul mice and nothing. And I borrowed money. And now the debtor, the collector, the creditor is coming to collect. And I don't have anything to pay him. He's going to take my children as slaves. And Elisha says, go get as many empty vessels as you can and start pouring oil in. And as long as there's empty vessels, there's no shortage of oil. The oil lasts until it's not needed anymore. Exactly the story of Chanukah. And now, the last thing I want to show you is to come back to our original story of darkness engulfing the world for 3 days. Where does darkness engulf the world for 3 days? There's only one place in Tanakh where that happens, and that is plague number 9 in Egypt. In Egypt. Now let's go back. Where was the Torah translated into Greek? In Egypt. Ptolemy is the king of Egypt. And so the way that this story is told, and again, this story only shows up in a post-Chazal text, but that the 8th of Tevet, today is a fast day because the Torah was translated into Greek and darkness engulfed the world for 3 days, is clearly picking up on the story of Mitzrayim. And it's almost as if to say that the translation of the Torah into Greek puts us back at a pre-Matan Torah, pre-Yetziat Mitzrayim point. It's clearly degrading and denigrating the enterprise of the translation of Tanakh into Greek, at least at that point. So what we've seen over the course of the last 27 minutes, is that Agadot Chazal, the stories that Chazal tell, and I'm not at all dealing with the historicity of the stories. The historicity of the story with Yitro and Bilam and Eov is of a very different nature than of Rav Shimon Bar Yochai and his colleagues. But I'm looking at the way that Chazal tell the stories. And the way that Chazal tell the stories seems to be that the Tanakh is the blueprint for storytelling. And that we have the story of the oil that becomes a story built on the story of Elisha. We have the story of the translation in Egypt. It gets built on the darkness of Egypt. When you get to the story of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai running away from the government, Eliyahu becomes the model for that. And the way that the stories are told is very much shaped by the way that those same stories are told in Tanakh. One last note. I gave this shiur, I noted at the beginning, my mother's yahrzeit is tonight. And I really wanted to dedicate it to her memory, Miriam Bat Yitzchak Verivka. My mom was somebody who instilled in me at a very young age a real love for Tanakh. And I credit her very much with a lot of the things that I do in Tanakh, but also with noticing when reading Agadot Chazal, noticing the Tanakh basis for them, being able to make that connection. Making these connections is something that I absolutely credit her with, and just wanted to invoke her memory on this thoughtful day and at the end of this shiur. Yehi zichra baruch.